from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. It's not enough that Dr. Paul Lindy must sometimes function as both judge and jury. Sometimes it would help to be clairvoyant as well. Lindy is an emergency room psychiatrist at San Francisco General Hospital, where he sees people who are in a world of hurt, from those strung out on drugs to those who might commit suicide. And he must decide how to help, who should stay, and who should go. It's a world he describes in a compelling new book called Danger to Self. We'll talk to Dr. Paul Lindy after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. When Dr. Paul Lindy goes to work, here's how he describes what he sometimes sees. This afternoon in the day room, a young woman picks at scabs in her forearms, moaning, gently banging her head against the wall. A thin, wound-up little old lady paces back and forth, singing old Broadway tunes repetitively, loudly, and off-key. And two young men, clearly county jail graduates, yell at each other, threatening to punch each other's lights out. Dr. Paul Lindy is an emergency room psychiatrist at San Francisco General Hospital. His world is full of the extreme, representing all the pain and hurt that life can sometimes offer. But it's also a world where the heart can sometimes bind the wounds left behind. Paul Lindy has written a new book about emergency psychiatry called Danger to Self, On the Front Line with an ER Psychiatrist, and he joins us for this hour of Forum. Paul Lindy, good morning.
Thanks. My pleasure to be here, Dave.
Happy to have you walk down the street from SF General just a few blocks away.
That's right. I've logged a couple hours already, and I came down here, and a couple of my colleagues are covering for me, so thanks to them.
Describe that world that they're covering. I read a brief excerpt that describes part of it, but what's the world that you left behind this morning at the ER psychiatry emergency room?
Well, this morning was relatively intense. There are 21 patients there. And, you know, I had one individual lying on the floor, sort of pounding against the wall, babbling. Another guy, you know, in his wheelchair trying to get into the bathroom, but mistaking the interview room for the bathroom. So I helped him into the bathroom. And, you know, these are just the kind of things that come up on a day-to-day basis. It's a very, not all the time, but frequently a very intense feeling of chaos there. And sometimes really unbelievable. It's even now, 20 years later, sometimes hard to believe just the amount of entropy, human entropy going on there, and also really the level of suffering and tragedy. I mean, I looked at one woman this morning and I said, I can't imagine what it would be like to be inside of her brain. And that just sort of popped into my head, you know. And there are other days, though, that are more routine and that it's not like that. But today certainly was one of those days where there's, you know, six or eight people just wandering about.
And you've been in that world for, as you say, some 20 years. You describe it as sometimes being like a cyclone. What keeps you inside it? What makes it a world that you want to be a part of?
Well, there's a certain addiction to people who work there. I mean, most of the nurses have been there for 10 years and more. I'd say most of the doctors at this point have been there for 10 years or more. And it's a combination of factors. I mean, I think one is the stimulation is addicting, actually having that much going on. Secondly, the challenge and the novelty. You never know what you're going to come across on a given day. And I kind of gotten to the point where I don't even register anymore. I kind of have to force myself sometimes to even write down things that are unusual because I'm so used to the unusual. So the novelty is great. The intellectual challenges are great as well. We often have to play detective in trying to piece together a story with inadequate information. And that is really a lot of fun and challenging and helpful. I think the third point is that there's a certain amount of compassion that can be rendered there. A little bit of kindness can go a long way. And that's actually very appealing to me.
Is the immediacy both the challenge and the reward that you have to sort of be on and in the moment and at your best every second?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's for people, as my colleague Bob Buckley, who's kind of my mentor there, has been here, been there longer than I have, he sort of said, you know, we're sort of the couch potatoes of adrenaline junkies. In other words, we're the kind of people that are able to sort of sit quietly by, but we might sort of get lost in our own thoughts. But when you have this immediacy going on, it forces you to get up and make a decision and do something, and it kind of gets one out of his or her torpor to do something. And it's there's a buzz. I mean, both empathy causes a pleasure response in the human body. There's research that supports it. So there's the empathic, and then there's just the adrenaline rush, because from time to time, it's potentially dangerous.
The stakes are high. I mean, you're dealing with – this is not people coming in to urgent care with a sore throat.
No, and I'm not to say that those particular tasks are very important to the person with a sore throat, of course. But I think you know, more than half of our cases are brought in by the police who put patients on a 5150, which 5150 is the state welfare and institutions code for 72-hour commitment. So the police bring people in for either being suicidal, homicidal, or gravely disabled, unable to care for themselves. And so the vast majority of our patients are there against their will. So you have that variable in and of itself. You have people who do not want to be there, and you have to somehow tell them, I'm sorry, this is out of your control. We'll do the best we can. So that makes it challenging.
Let's back up for a moment and explain the context for that, because this is something that's evolved over time in terms of this question of voluntary and involuntary commitment, consent, all of those sorts of questions. So the situation that we have now is that people come to you not of their own free will. They are largely brought there, and state law, the welfare code, has this section, the 5150 section that you mentioned, that says you can hold them there against their will for up to 3 days if you make that determination.
That's correct. I mean, you always have the option of dropping the hold and discharging someone. You know, this kind of law has been on the books in California for about 35 years. There were a huge overhaul of civil commitment laws in the early 70s. It's called LPS law, Lantrum and Petras Short. They were the three assembly members who drafted the legislation in the early 70s. And so if you think about the early 70s in California and elsewhere, it was during the civil rights era. So on the one hand, you had a group of people really advocating for protecting a person's rights. And, you know, this made a lot of sense because in the 50s and 60s in the United States, there were really tremendous abuses of commitment law. There were the days where a man could get his wife committed if she wanted to divorce him, for example, or it'd be very easy for a family to commit somebody with kind of an indeterminate amount of, let's just say, sentencing. So you'd have people languishing in a state hospital for months with no due process. And so that was obviously not a good situation. So there was, I would say, the pendulum swung rather briskly to the other side, where we wanted to write in a lot of protection of civil liberties. At the same time, there were financial economic pressures going on. And this was during the time that Governor Reagan, shortly after this, deinstitutionalized patients. And so you had this influx of people who were previously in the state hospitals, now either out on the streets often or sometimes drifting into incarceration. So there's a combination of both sort of political, historical factors that went into the drafting of the law, as well as economic factors. I mean, it was expensive to have people in state hospitals. The funding, the savings from closing the state hospitals were meant to sort of funnel to the community, but I think the funds got lost along the way.
Dr. Paul Lindy is our guest this hour. His new book is called Danger to Self: On the Front Line with an ER Psychiatrist. And sometimes that danger to self can not only include the patient, of course, it can also include you. You cite the percentage of psychiatrists in your line of work that can be assaulted. I think it's something like 40% over the lifetime of their career. And I want you to describe one chapter. The book is largely composed of case studies of your experiences in the ER. And I'd like you to describe the chapter about someone who comes in who's homicidal. He's planning to kill his boss.
Yeah, that was by far one of the most dramatic things that I'd ever experienced. And to put things into context, three of the chapters actually come from my training at UCSF. I did internship and residency there. One of the chapters comes from some work at a private hospital. The other chapters are from the psych ER. So here I am. I'm a third-year resident. as green as you can get. I'm just starting to do outpatient evaluations. This is over at Langley Porter. And, you know, most of the patients I saw were fairly garden variety, depression or anxiety, people you could actually sit down, have a conversation, spend three or four meetings really getting to know them well, and then putting together a treatment plan. And that sort of is the world of outpatient psychotherapy, and it's a great world to be in, and you know, that's a nice skill to learn. But every once in a while, you pull a joker from the pack. And this particular referral was from a primary care doctor at UC. And the patient, you know, I guess I didn't really recognize the danger fully when I looked at the consultation request. You know, you look at a few sentences on a piece of paper, and I called the primary care doctor. And this particular patient came in, and he was pretty quiet with me initially. He looked kind of nervous, but he certainly didn't look psychotic. And we sit down in my little cramped little office, which fit the level of a third-year resident. And he immediately stands up in my office. You know, and I had already sort of seen all sorts of different things, so it didn't really bother me too much. But he starts tapping the walls, and he systematically is tapping my walls from floor to ceiling, all over my office. And I have no idea what he's doing. And as he's doing this, he starts to hyperventilate. It's getting very red in the face, intense, and, you know, looks like he's going to explode. And I didn't know what to do. I mean, I really just went to my own sort of gut instinct, and I said, hey, you know, sir, what's going on? You look real upset. You know, I didn't really know what else to do. And he kind of looked at me, and he sort of, it's almost like he came out of a trance state, and he slowly calmed down. He stopped tapping the walls. He sat down. And I was able then to have a conversation with him over time. So whatever he was thinking about doing, I was able to bring him out of that state, and we were able to have a conversation. Well, then, you know, it turns out in the course of things, I found out he's planning to kill his boss, and he had an elaborate system for creating a car bomb that was radio controlled, and he seemed like the kind of person in his history that would have the capacity to do so. So I had to make a decision pretty early on whether I was going to try to warn his boss of this possible, you know, murder.
Because that's the one thing you are allowed to do, where you can violate confidentiality,
yeah,
if you deem that someone else is in grave danger.
So this is spins off from the Tarasoff case from the mid-1980s. It's Tarasoff. And there was a case in which a therapist was informed by a patient that he was planning to kill a person. And at that time, you could not violate confidentiality no matter what. And it turned out that this individual murdered this other person, and there was a lawsuit filed on behalf of this person's family. I mean, if you guys want to look up the details, you can Google Tarasoff. And basically, then that became case law. So really, I was doing this evaluation over at UC in the early 90s, so this case law was pretty early on. Now, in retrospect, I probably should have done a Tarasoff warning. The gentleman actually told me the name of his boss and how to get a hold of him. And I think in retrospect, I probably should have done it. But at the time, I made a decision to not do it because I was afraid that I might alienate him and that he wouldn't come back and see me again. And then I, of course, got supervision from three different sources, and I got three different pieces of advice. So one said, hey, that was the right thing. And another said, you blew it. So,
but I also wanted to ask you some about what you said to that particular individual, because after he described how he was going to kill his boss, he also indicated to you that he might have to take care of anybody that he told this
yeah,
to.
That's
so
right.
You in fact, were threatened by that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And in that circumstance, you wind up responding to him, and you say something, this is what you wrote, you said, if you want me to help you, then you're going to have to take back that threat. If you can't do that, then I suggest that you leave and go find someone else to help you. Now, again, we should clarify that this was not at the ER. This is in a different situation. But what interested me about your comment is that you spoke from the heart at that moment. You said
yes,
what was on your mind, and it seemed to make a difference.
Yeah, I mean, I had to think, obviously, when he made that threat, and it felt real. I didn't feel like he was going to assault me right then, but it felt like here's a guy who's capable of it. And I actually am trying to think in retrospect, I may have gotten that from supervision, you know, from previously, even as a third-year resident, that if that came up, that was a response. But certainly consciously, I wasn't responding. It was really unconsciously. And because I'm thinking, well, you know, hey, I can't help you if you're threatening me. I need to be your ally. And so he actually, you know, calmed down even further at that point, and he seemed to buy it. You know, he seemed to get it.
Which in turn allowed you to assess that he probably wasn't going to do that, and therefore you elected not to warn his boss. But it's indicative of what you seem to say is that one of the principal attributes that you have to do in dealing with the population you do, these people who are in a world of hurt, whether they're threatening someone else or feeling threatened or feeling like they might commit suicide, and that is that you have to speak from the heart. And you have to speak with sort of an instant insight. You have to go with what you're feeling.
Yeah. Well, for me, I have to. And that's probably another reason why I've stayed in that environment is that because I usually only see people a time or two, I sort of feel like I'm able to extend myself a little bit more without feeling like I'm going to be taken advantage of or, you know, being too nice per se. It's easy for me to be kind to someone in that situation. But that's sort of what's kept me there as well. But I do think for me, that's the way that I've operated, that I sort of feel like that the emotional connection piece with a patient needs to be there simultaneously with whatever the intellectual piece is or the diagnostic piece. And that's something that for me, I get to integrate my feeling parts of myself with my intellectual parts of myself. And that really feels great to be able to integrate those. And so you're absolutely right. I don't think every psychiatrist operates the same way, but I think a number of them do.
Dr. Paul Lindy, our guest this hour, his book, Danger to Self, On the Frontline with an ER Psychiatrist. Obviously, having someone who's homicidal is not the norm in your day-to-day work at SF General. But you do see people who are acutely hurting. And in this city in particular, and it's interesting because in the first hour of Forum this morning, we talked about the city of San Francisco and whether or not it's being well run as a government and the peculiarities of San Francisco. And one of those peculiarities is a sizable population of needy people, of homeless people, of people who have real drug problems, for example. And you see a lot of those folks. Describe Ray, someone you write about in your book, because it speaks to this question of the safety net that we want to offer here in the city of San Francisco.
So one of the chapters is about a patient who I call Ray Shellam, and he's a very typical kind of patient that we see there. He's someone with pretty severe alcoholism, but also with concurrent schizophrenia that's more or less in remission. And basically the point is if you want to stay. No, if you want to stay, you have to go. If you want to go, you have to stay. So in this situation, he would be a guy.
Meaning?
Well, in this situation, he's someone who I probably, in the old days, I would have admitted because he wasn't caring for himself. So here's a guy who comes in wearing six layers of clothes, smells very bad, has a huge uncombed beard. He hasn't washed in 2 months. He smells bad. He looks sick. His teeth are in poor repair. Someone who I think in the old days who would have admitted just to sort of, you know, for a week or so to kind of tune up. And so in that case, he's someone who wouldn't want to be admitted. You know, he feels perfectly fine, you know, with his eight layers of Levi's and being out there. But nowadays, actually, because this particular person's not dangerous, I mean, he's not suicidal. He's not actually homicidal, and he's not a person who's much of a violence risk. He's an older man who's happy living on the street. So in this situation, he's someone who's gravely disabled is the terminology. So these are the patients now that are most likely to fall through the cracks because we're sort of being asked to prioritize admitting patients to the hospital who are either suicidal or potentially violent. It's harder to keep people in the hospital who aren't dangerous. And this is – it's an economic reality. It's not a philosophical reality.
And it's also the reality of what some of those individuals want. You say at one point you sort of sputter to him, don't you want me to help you? And, and he says, no, I'd rather go back out on the street.
Yeah. Well, if you read – there's a book by E. Fuller Torrey called The Insanity Offense, and he's a pretty famous psychiatrist and theoretician. And essentially there's a group of people with schizophrenia, and one of their hallmark symptoms is a lack of insight. So we're not talking about Woody Allen neurotic lack of insight. We're talking about a fundamental self-neglect, heedlessness, that not caring if you stink and you haven't bathed in 2 months and, you know, you have eight layers of clothes on and you have lice. It's just you don't even register it. And for certain people with severe schizophrenia, that actually is a symptom of their disease, is a lack of insight, a lack of capacity. And there's really a move afoot to try to look at people who have this fundamental lack of capacity and say, are these people that we should compel them to actually get treatment?
And where do you come down on that? Do you want to compel the rays of the world to get treatment that they don't want?
Well, it's a really good question, and I have to say it's a case-by-case basis.
What did you want to do with Ray?
You know, I was happy enough to let him go because he's a fairly typical kind of patient, mostly because he is, in some ways, was protected because he had this lack of insight. He was not depressed. He seemed content to, you know, drink himself silly every day and rummage through garbage cans. I mean, honest to goodness, he did not seem to mind.
And do you think then, I mean, it raises a really interesting question about what kind of society we are, what kind of city we are in San Francisco. Do you think that's a choice that we should allow people to make?
Well, I'm going to say not always. I would say sometimes. And I think there are cases where we should be more assertive in actually saying, this is someone who lacks capacity. This is someone who needs to have an involuntary commitment as an outpatient. Hmm. Now, there are laws on the books called Laura's Law in California. It's not instituted in San Francisco. It's a cumbersome, difficult mental health act, and there's no funding. The state said, you can do this county by county basis. You guys can do involuntary outpatient commitment. But there was no extra funding. So in San Francisco, I think because of the political realities and also economic realities, this isn't going to happen unless there's some overhaul in mental health law. I think it might be coming. I think in some cases, we shouldn't allow people to live like this. And I think in some cases, you make a decision and say that weighing the risk and the benefit. And, you know, I definitely believe in freedom and civil liberties, and I've kind of swung that way the more experienced I am. But I think there are certain of these patients we need to be more assertive about.
We have to take a break in a moment, but I want to turn next, and we'll just introduce this and then come back to that, to one of the toughest decisions you have to make, which is people who come in and are suicidal. In that moment, what's the first thing that you try to assess? And we'll talk more about this after the break, but what's the first thing that you try to assess in that situation?
Well, you do have to assess of how imminent their suicidality is, because in rare instances, you have someone who wants to injure themselves right then, right now. So we do have to do things like take sharp objects away from people. We have to take their belts off. We have to take their shoelaces off, because this happens time and time again that people try to hang themselves in psych emergency. People try to self-mutilate. So you definitely need to make measures right away. It's unusual, but it happens. And then I think you need to really gather information as quickly as possible from the patient and also from collateral sources as well to decide how serious is their suicide risk. So basically making a risk assessment is the next step.
It's one of clearly the most toughest of the decisions you have to make. And we'll talk more when we come back about how you make that choice and the consequences of those choices as well. Dr. Paul Lindy, our guest this hour, his compelling new book is called Danger to Self, On the Front Line with an ER Psychiatrist. We want to open up our phone lines, too, if you'd like to join us and phone in your thoughts on this subject. Here's the number. It's 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. Or you can email us your comments at forum@kqed.org. And you can also leave your questions and comments on our website. To do that, just go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this particular segment. Back with more with Dr. Paul Lindy in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Dr. Paul Lindy is our guest this hour. He's written an interesting, fascinating, really, new book called Danger to Self, On the Front Line with an ER Psychiatrist. He's been an ER psychiatrist at San Francisco General for the past 20 years. He joins us this hour. We'd welcome your comments and thoughts about this subject matter as well. Here's the numbers if you want to join us, 866- 833-6786, 866-733-6786. Or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. We'll get to your calls in one moment. But just before the break, Paul Lindy, we were talking about one of the tougher, if not the toughest, assessment you have to make is people who come in who are suicidal. And there are two chapters, as I recall, in the book that deal with this, one with differing outcomes. And I want to ask you first about the story of a character you call Will. The chapter is called The Clairvoyant, which in itself obviously is telling because you have this pretty awesome responsibility, one which really isn't even possible to achieve.
That's right. I mean, we're asked to try to predict behavior, which is almost impossible. I mean, I'll just be really honest about that. And essentially, the bread and butter case for us is someone who is suicidal, having suicidal thoughts. And it's really the task is not so much to try to predict behavior as to make some sort of assessment of the risk of a person actually committing suicide. And there's lots of variables to look at. I think we've gotten smarter over the years about identifying the variables, the research. There has been progress. It doesn't necessarily mean the outcomes have been better statistically nationwide. The suicide rate is still high, but we're getting smarter about assessing it.
And in the story of Will, this is a young man, age 20 or so, who comes in distraught about the breakup with a girlfriend, taken an overdose of pills combined with drinking. He had a lot of positives in his life as well, a loving father, a number of things that in the end led you to believe that he was going to be okay if he underwent a therapy. And so you decided to not hold him at SF General. And then what happened?
Well, Dave, this is a situation, I think, where my heart and my subjectivity and my feeling self, rather than helping me, led me astray. And it's a difficult thing to admit. Because what happened in this situation, if I look at the risk variables objectively, and certainly now in retrospect, the risk was at least moderate, if not moderate to high. And someone who, in retrospect, of course, I would have admitted to the hospital. At the time, however, this is the first time he'd done something like this. He'd never been in a psych ward before. He was kind of a middle class sort of a kid, young man. And I made a decision to not admit him to the hospital because I didn't want to subject this middle class young man to the psych ward. And I also found myself over-identifying with him in terms of having broken up with a girlfriend recently. And of course, who hasn't had those situations, particularly as a teenager or a young adult. And I thought, he'll get past this and maybe forgetting just how devastating that is, particularly when you're young. And I think the thing that swayed me the most is that I had a chance to meet his father. And far more often than not, we don't meet family members or even friends. I mean, usually people that we see are alone in the world for the most part. And I had a chance to meet his father. He had had young children in a second marriage. My kids were pretty much the same age at the same time. This father was close to me in age. I mean, I also identified strongly with him. And I looked at him and said, good guy, solid guy. He's going to be there for his son. And he was.
And so you let him go. And then days later, learned that he had indeed committed suicide. And I can hear that you're hurting about this still.
And of course, when you told me during the break that we were going to talk about this chapter, I forget about it. It was by far the most painful thing to write about in the book, and there's a lot of painful things in there. But, you can't undo what's been done, and it does give you pause, and I have to say it probably has made me a little bit more cautious. But the most important thing is I don't allow myself to have this pitfall.
But it sounds like your strength is also your weakness. It sounds like what makes you good, the ability to identify and to have insights and be willing to say what's in your heart, that quality which allows you to help the most in this particular case led you off course.
Yeah, by all means. And that's life, right? I mean, we all take risks. We're all imperfect. And So You know, so part of me wants to be that more sort of checklist marking, yeah, white coat wearing, objective psychiatrist who's not swayed by these matters of the heart. But that's not who I am. So absolutely.
Paul Lindy, again, our guest this hour. We'll take your calls as well. Let's go to Jubal first, who joins us from Santa Cruz. Jubal, go ahead, please.
Hi, Dr. Lindy. My girlfriend just basically suffered a loss of a friend who killed himself yesterday. Their relationship spanned over 15 years, and prior to his committing suicide, he had attempted to get a hold of her a few times, and she didn't respond to the phone calls, and she's feeling guilty about not taking that call. And I was just wondering if, had she taken that call, would that have affected maybe his decision to follow through with the suicide?
Well, first of all, I want to say I'm so sorry to hear of this loss. I mean, it's always an incredible loss, and, you know, truly potentially preventable. You know, it's hard to say what the answer to that question is. I do think that contact probably might have given this man an opportunity to reconsider his thoughts. Obviously, he was very serious about taking his life because he did it. But I do think there's a chance that it might have prevented it. By the same token, I think for her, you know, she has to feel like she made decisions for a certain reason. And, you know, I don't know the details, but, you know, you can't go back in time and redo it. So I think she is going to need to find a way to somehow deal with the loss and forgive herself for not picking up the phone. And, you know, we can always say, what if? I do think she would benefit from perhaps contacting a group that there are groups out there that work with survivors of suicide. Off the top of my head, I don't know the references, but just go to Google, you know, survivors of suicide. I think that might even be the acronym SOS. I think she's going to need some help.
Jubal, thanks for the call. And it's a point you also acknowledge within the book that you reference talking to your own therapist, that people who contend with these sorts of issues, whether that's the person our caller just references or you in your everyday life, need help as well, need support as well.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, I've had my own issues with depression and even suicidal thoughts, and so I really know from whence I speak. And, you know, it's pretty sobering. I think suicide is the kind of thing anybody can do, you know. And unfortunately, all it takes is one mistake and one impulsive moment, and that could be the end. I mean, that's really, I've come around to believe we need a barrier on the Golden Gate Bridge. I would say probably half of those folks, it's impulsive. They just go, I'm going to do it. Boom. It's a forfeit barrier. They're over. So, I mean, I used to say, nah, don't do it. If people are going to kill themselves, they're going to kill themselves. But a lot of them do it impulsively.
Back to our call. Sharon in Fremont joins us next. Sharon, go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to know how Dr. Lindy feels about the pharmaceutical industry, advertising drugs. Like, we have a solution for this problem. We have a solution for that, especially when it's mind-boggling that children, usually, you know, under 21 or even very young adults that are entering college, that feel like they should take that drug because they'll feel so much better. And, you know, being a parent here in the Bay Area is a lot of stress with young people going to college and wondering what the future is going to be holding because, you know, our state has all these irregularities of just having teachers. So then, you know, forethought, of course, is, oh, you don't need drugs, don't take them. But Dr. Lindy feel about these pharmaceuticals saying that, oh, we have this new drug, we should try this for this young age group, or maybe this older age group should take this depression drug so they'll feel better. How does he feel about that? Because the advertising with pharmaceuticals seems to be all over every channel.
Mm. Yeah, and, Sharon, thanks. Yeah, no, it's an interesting point, the culture in which we live.
Well, thank you for the question. It's complex and broad, and I'll say a few things. One is, you know, I have problems with the pharmaceutical companies. I think they have been far too aggressive in their direct-to-consumer advertising, and frankly, I think they need to kill off direct-to-consumer advertising. I think it does more harm than good. So having said that, I will say I do think that I think the key is finding a professional who you trust, who you know is going to be comprehensive and evaluate the other factors other than just medication. So unfortunately now psychiatrists have become pill peddlers. Insurance companies have put them into that box because they don't want to pay for more comprehensive services from the psychiatrist.
And you also make the point in the book in a different setting, obviously, than our caller is talking about in terms of broader social issues, that drugs are necessary and that you use drugs every day and that they play a huge role in helping people.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think certainly the patients that I see, the severity of symptoms are so disturbing and disabling. People are suffering. I mean, I think it's clear that medications are helpful. And, you know, I see outpatients as well, or I have. You know, you do sometimes need to make a decision to use medication. It needs to be made. It's a carefully made decision. I think your point about medicating children is an excellent one. It's not an area of my expertise. I mean, I have friends who've looked into it. But I think part of what you're referring to is kids going off to college and taking their friends' Adderall is part of what I think you're getting at. And that's a huge problem. I'll say this. I've prescribed Adderall for people with real ADHD, and I've monitored it, and they've done well. But I do think it's dangerous to have a casual attitude toward prescribing any of these meds. But on the other hand, they're often a necessary tool.
I want to give out a couple of numbers. Jubal, who called or was our first caller, asking about how to help someone whose friend had recently committed suicide. And Dr. Lindy made the point that someone in that situation would need help as well. Here are a couple of numbers you could consider calling if you are in that situation or know someone is. The 24-hour crisis hotline number, which is 1-800-309-2131, 800-309-2131. Or there's also another nationwide hotline for suicide in particular, and that's 1-800-SUICIDE, 1-800-SUICIDE. So a couple of numbers if you're in that circumstance or know someone who's in that circumstance who needs that kind of assistance. Let's go to Chris next in Santa Clara. Chris, go ahead.
Hello. I'm calling as a follow-up to Jubal because I'm a bit disappointed with Dr. Lindy's response to him. As a woman who's suffered with depression my whole life, and though I've never attempted suicide, I've often contemplated it. I believe that if a person is going to commit suicide, they are going to do it, regardless of what anyone says to them.
Chris,
I don't believe
Chris,
that his girlfriend was going to make a difference. She may have made a difference that night, but she was not going to make a difference in the long run.
I think it's an excellent point, and I wasn't suggesting that it was a slam dunk that would have prevented him from ever committing suicide, but I do understand your point. And this is the thing that makes this job so stressful is that I absolutely get that point that if someone is bound and determined to commit suicide, there's not much you can do except to tell them, I wish you would make a different decision. I wish I could find a way to help you find some hope and some meaning.
Chris, thank you for the call. And it raises one of the points that you talk about in that chapter of the book as part of what you search for in that circumstance is ambiguity, that there are people, as Chris suggests, who might be bound and determined. But there are also people where there's ambiguity, where there's uncertainty, where they might have someone, some connection that might make them want to hang on, and that's what you try to hone in on.
Yeah, so it's called really working with the ambivalence, and this is something that psychiatrists learn hopefully early on, is that when you have someone who's suicidal, you need to explore the ambivalence and find out really both what are their reasons for doing so and how compelling are they to actually commit suicide. But at the same time, trying to survey them, are there variables that mitigate against it? Are there things that would make it so that they wouldn't make that choice? And ultimately, suicide's a choice. I mean, that's what's so difficult about the whole situation.
Francis in Sonoma writes in, does Dr. Lindy feel that the number of people who are despondent and possibly dangerous to themselves or others has increased with the current recession, and by what degree?
Well, it's hard for me to gauge. I mean, working at a county public hospital, the misery quotient is always fairly high. I can't say it's much higher now than it was before the recession. I will say that our access to outpatient services has gotten more difficult to obtain. So you know, I tend to see people who are on the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum. Occasionally, I've had patients come through who, because of a job loss, have developed depression. So certainly, I'm going to speculate that there is more depression going on out there now because of it. I would have little doubt that that's true, but I really don't have the experience or the numbers to back that up.
And this also raises another difficult part of what you contend with as an emergency room psychiatrist, which is there's the question of ambivalence, whether or not someone is determined, making, as it turned out, the wrong call in the case of someone like Will. But then you also have to contend with people who, for lack of a better word, sort of fake their symptoms because they want to be there. They want a few meals and a warm place to sleep. Nothing wrong with that. Understandable, in fact, in many ways. But
right. That's
part of what you also have to sift through.
If you want to stay, you have to go. So, and unfortunately, this may be among the most common scenarios that we see on a day-to-day basis, and that is...
And again, just to understand what that means when you say, if you want to say you have to go, you're saying someone who comes in and says, Doc, I really need to be here. I need to be here for my 72 hours. I know that's what's allowed under 5150.
Right.
That tells you something.
And it's painful because obviously this is a person who needs a lot of things. They need services. They might, you know, they need a job. They need money. They need a place to stay. But they may or may not be psychiatrically ill to the point that I'm going to keep them. So the way the laws are written now, because we're, you know, in the position of trying to predict behavior, people know that if they say they're suicidal, that, you know, we do really need to bring them in for an evaluation. And we actually might have services to offer them, even despite the fact they don't need to put them in the hospital. So it's a reasonable thing to do.
And you also have police bringing people in sometimes because it's, as you put it, easier for them to do that, less paperwork than to take them to jail.
Yeah, and I don't want to be too cynical about that. I don't think that happens a lot. I think the police in San Francisco do a very good job overall, but you know they also get frustrated and they sometimes bring people to us that don't need to be there, but it's our determination.
Sandy in Richmond has our next question. Sandy, go ahead, please, to Dr. Paul Lindy.
Yes, actually, I don't have a question. I just wanted to share that in the early 90s, I was 5150'd at San Francisco General for suicidality that arose out of extreme deep clinical depression. And I'm very, very, very grateful that because I was actively trying to kill myself at the time that I was discovered and taken to the hospital. And I'm just so grateful that I was admitted. I received excellent care. It was not a bedlam upstairs. It was a very healing, calm environment. And ultimately, we found a treatment, which is electroshock therapy. Modern electroshock therapy is very, it's not painful. It's very helpful and has been a great aid to me. And I personally don't believe that everyone who thinks of committing suicide is ultimately going to do it. I was in a state of crisis, and I was ill with very severe depression, and once I was found treatment for that, I've been fine.
Sandy, thanks, and great to hear that you're doing so well and that you got the help you needed at SF General.
Thank you. I mean,
Sorry, Sandy. I didn't mean to cut you off. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, we tend not to get positive feedback. We occasionally get very nice cards and letters, and you know, run across people who actually have done well. So thank you very much for your call.
Here's another question from someone who's experienced your world and brings up another interesting point. And it goes back to some of the story you told about Will, that you didn't want to put Will in that particular environment. This person writes, my name is Deepa. I had suicidal thoughts and called for help. I was taken to the emergency room in Santa Clara County. But my question is, I was more disturbed being there around a lot of really unfortunate, disturbed people, and now I'm having nightmares about that place. Mm. Do you think the people who have suicidal thoughts should be counseled separately rather than putting them in that environment?
That's an excellent point. And in fact, you know, I remember making this all the way back as a third-year medical student in the 1980s, asking my supervisor, a full professor of psychiatry, this question, sort of like, well, how does it affect people to be in such this kind of environment? I think it's a good thought. And I think, you know, ideally we'd be able to sort of separate out patients, severity of illness perhaps, and psychotic and non-psychotic. I think it's an excellent point. Will it happen? Probably not, because of financial constraints. I mean, more and more, you know, units actually are closing. So.
But it's part of what you've got away is will this person benefit from being in this,
right,
as you described at the very beginning of this program, this place that feels like a cyclone?
Well, yeah, and I talk to people who are in a true crisis and who've never been in a place like that before, and, you know, identify with them to the level of like, whoa, you know, this must be a real eye-opener for you. You know, it's very intense here, and, you know, sort of, you know, to acknowledge, it's like, you know, you're like a regular working person and this must kind of blow you away, and to own that. And if I can, you know, release them, it's all good. And if I have to subject them to it, I sort of say, I'm sorry, but that's the way it is.
Jason joins us next in San Francisco. Jason, go ahead.
Yes, hi, doctor. My name is Jason Grant Garza, and I've had the unfortunate experience of having been denied emergency services at San Francisco General. And as a patient, after being manipulated and risk managed by patient advocacy, because it falls under risk management, and going to federal court and having the city test the lie in federal court to have my case dismissed, and then later to get a signed confession from the Office of Inspector General where the city finally admits having broken the Impala law, the emergency law. As a person seeking services, the disingenuousness and the corruption and everything and the lack of honor and to be able to trust once again when now that I have a signed confession, the people that you work for can't even come clean or do the right thing with contrition so that a person can forgive and move on.
Jason, I'm going to interject if I might. Yeah, no, I hear you, and I hear the concerns that you had and the experience that you had, and I'd like to give Dr. Lindy a chance to respond to what you can hear in Jason's voice, the kind of unhappiness he had with the way in which he was treated in this particular system.
Well, I you know, I'm not surprised that that kind of experience is had by some people who come to be triaged either at psychiatric emergency or the medical emergency service. You know, I'm just going to be really blunt and say I think it's highly variable in the triage area depending on who's doing triage, that I think some folks are more likely to be more compassionate and others are less likely to feel like they're gatekeepers of an overloaded system. It's a difficult job, and I'm certainly not trying to defend anybody's actions, you know, with respect to your situation, but it's really, really variable.
How do you keep your heart open? I mean, you refer to one person, I think, in the book as being sort of Nurse No, that there is this tendency, if you've been there for a long time, to be tough, to sort of close the door rather than open the door, often for really understandable reasons. How do you keep open?
Well, I mean, I have to personally to sort of keep going and doing the work. I guess I've maybe protected myself a little bit from having to do the triage role since it's the registered nurses, psychiatric nurses who do that role. I'm not sure I could do that job. I think I would be someone who would let most people in. And so I just know myself well enough to know I wouldn't be able to do that job. And my hat is off to people who can balance it. But you do have to find balance. There are situations where you do have to set limits. I can certainly set limits when it's clear they need to be set. But I tend to err on the side of giving people the benefit of the doubt.
Laureen in Woodside. Go ahead, please. Laureen, you're on. Are you with us?
Oh, hi. Yeah. I have two brothers with schizophrenia. And many years ago, my brother had to be admitted to San Francisco General. I have a question about two questions about medication. I'm meeting with my younger brother's doctor soon, and he's very symptomatic still. My older brother seems to be more mellow. I think that it sort of mellows out with age. But I'm curious, where should I go, website or anywhere, to research the most current medications? Because he's not getting much relief, and he's on so many meds.
Great,
and my
thanks.
Second question is, I'd love to be able to contact you because I'm a writer, and I've been working on a book about Simon, and I'd love to be able to just get some tips from you if that's possible.
Let's go with at least your first question, and maybe you can take up the other one later. But where to research all of these medications? Laureen, thanks.
Well, probably the single best source would be to consult the National Institutes of Mental Health website. And again, off the top of my head, I don't know what it is, but it's NIMH. And I would just search for schizophrenia medications, and there should be a good review in there. I don't think you go too far wrong even with WebMD, actually, and just look schizophrenia or antipsychotic medications to help review. There's now a wide range of choices. The newer medications in general, much better tolerated, much safer, much easier to take.
It sounded like Lorene also wanted to follow up and ask you other things. I know you had a book reading at Book Passages in the City recently. Other opportunities where people who want to pursue this further can hear you, listen to you, talk to you, ask you questions?
Yeah, next week, actually, I'm going to be speaking at UCSF, the Parnassus campus, at 12 o'clock noon in the nursing building, room N217. That's Tuesday the 12th at noon. That's open to the public. And then next Thursday evening, I'll be at Books, Inc. on Market Street in the Castro at 7:30. Kepler's in Palo Alto on Tuesday the 19th. Those are sort of the
So Tuesday the 12th at UCSF, then at Books, Inc. on Thursday, following Tuesday at Kepler's. Just want to ask you one last thing. We just have a moment left about how you do what you do on a continuing basis, because when this program is over in about a minute and 20 seconds, you're going to walk back down the street 10 blocks or so from here and go right back to the emergency psych room at SF General. What's going to greet you? What are you going to try to do?
Well, I think it's impossible to say. I mean, on Fridays, one of my main jobs is to do consultations in the medical emergency room, and sometimes I get three or four, and sometimes I get zero. So I'm going to guess I'm going to have a consult waiting for me to see in the ER, and I have some admission orders to write for people who are being admitted to the hospital. But, you know, what I really keeps me going is the people I work with. The camaraderie is very welcoming. It's an atmosphere where I'm allowed to sort of be kind of an off-the-cuff, stream-of-consciousness kind of a person. And that's a really great day-to-day relief for me. And it's important to have a life outside of work, obviously. So that keeps me going in terms of family and spending time with my kids and writing. So,
Dr. Paul Lindy, our guest this hour. Book again is called Danger to Self, On the Front Line with an ER Psychiatrist. As you go back to work, I hope you have a very good day.
Thank you, Dave. It's been a pleasure.
Pleasure to have you here. Paul Lindy, our guest this hour. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, and Tina Lorberg. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer this hour, Danny Bringer. Our executive producer, Robo Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.